Oh, hey there, I'm Guy Branum. Welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. With me, it's like TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining, our digital strategist, Winter Mitchell Rohrbaugh.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello, Winter. What's going on?
Same.
Fair. We got journalist and novelist Margaret Wappler.
Hey there, Guy. I like Hunter Green for you.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's a really nice color for you. Yeah.
I'm doing what I can. And we got pop culture scholar and tech about town, Karen Toxin.
Hey, Guy. Hi, Rocketeers.
Karen, what a week for USA.
You know, every week I'm just waiting for an email to go to my inbox to see what's up.
Now, coming up on this big show, we're going to talk about Lady Vengeance, plus we'll each be sharing our latest gems. But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or events have caught our attention this week. Karen, just talk to us about what's going on.
Varsity Blues, everyone in the world. I mean, I, for one, just spent all of the day that this news dropped, which was yesterday, and we're recording on Wednesday. But like, I was just, the minute that one of the Rocketeers posted, I can't remember which one.
It was Daniel Barola.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, because the minute that I opened that thread, I saw Winter's comments. I saw like a roll of comments, and I was just all up in that. Because obviously, and also it happened to coincide with the email I received from the president of the university. another memo. Some memos that we've been getting a few of these memos in the last year or so. And for those of you who somehow were under a rock the other day or only following the 737 MAX 8 story, what happened is that the FBI busted an elaborate ring of many people involved in multiple industries, largely Silicon Valley, Hollywood, real estate, and they were all paying bribes to various figures attached to testing sites in universities, mostly through athletic departments, to bribe their kids' way into college. A few, the Entertainment Connect, of course, is a big one, and that's basically the headline that's on the news and that is trending everywhere, because Felicity Huffman and Lori Loughlin,
Aunt Becky went to jail.
Exactly,
Aunt Becky and Lynette.
I know. I try to call her something else, Loughlin, but anyway. So yeah, there's so many different angles to it. Among the things that, of course, I can't really speak to or about any of the particular students who are attached to some of these celebrities, in part because, you know, I may, depending on their continuing status, be responsible for grading them someday, and that would be bad. I wouldn't engage in that, but whoo-hoo, those parents.
I just love, nothing says louche Southern California entitlement like a sitcom star from 15 to 20 years ago. You know, like just a sitcom star from 15 to 20 years ago is just cruising along, doing all right. Like getting
the insecurity, the desperation, the thirst.
Also married to like the Mossimo clothing.
I mean,
guy.
I just loved this check-in with Lori Loughlin, where it was like, oh, you're married to the Mossimo guy?
I know, everyone collectively was like, wow, what a 90s power union that is.
Yeah, and like you have two gorgeous daughters who probably could have gotten into UCSB or something. Like, what was interesting to me was this need for people to be able to guarantee a label of respectability on their children. Or, you know, when you go deep into it, it's like, oh, their daughter got a 1420 on her own, but they were trying to like get, you know, more points in there. And it's like, she got a 1420. She's doing all right.
No, she got 1,000.
There was somebody else who got a 1420.
Yeah, there was. Yeah. I did dive into
that's
like.
That's fine. Yeah.
Yeah, I dove into all the court documents. So you could see, I mean, it's true that for much of what I read in the court, the FBI report is that these parents were doing it without their kids' knowledge. Okay, so there are a lot of kids who didn't have a sense of what was going on. In fact, they were conspiring with CW1 to basically, a cooperating witness one, to basically figure out how to snow their kids into like taking this test in a weird place like Houston or West Hollywood when they lived in upstate New York.
I have a jurisprudence question for you guys. Are you ready for it? Let's say one of the kids involved is in their freshman or sophomore year at this highly competitive school. They did nothing to make this situation happen, but they on their own merits did not earn their way into that school.
Right.
Should they be removed from that school?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I feel that, I mean, I think that if we came across, I'll go at this from the angle of someone who handles graduate admissions in a couple of my departments, right? And I once directed graduate admissions, or that's people applying to come take the PhD. If I found out that anyone falsified their credentials, that said they received a master's when they didn't, and or said they had a publication that didn't exist, I would, and we would collectively have to reassess and probably deny their, you know, their status.
There's so many things that people do to squeak around the system. And I think this is making us all realize that, like, the system's inherently broken. Yeah. So, like, even if you rooted out these particular kids, it's not like, okay, problem solved, dust your hands off. You know what I mean? Like, I personally, too, just don't have a lot of faith in tests, period. I think there's so many people that just don't adhere to tests and the way that they learn or the way that they perform their knowledge. And so I'm kind of like, I don't care about tests in the first place.
I love standardized tests because I think we have a deeply irregular educational system in this country that doesn't provide the same sort of like access to opportunities to people. And it's just like, my niece is she applied to college this fall, and just sort of the thing of, it doesn't cross anybody's mind that she went to a school that only had two AP classes or stuff like that. And like, standardized tests are a great way of saying, like, here's how I compare to another person from another, you know, from another situation. It's not perfect, but like, none of the parts of this are perfect.
Can I take the point of view of an Olivia Jade? I scored high, always in the top percentile on all standardized tests, and was in gifted and talented education gate. I'm a high school dropout. Uh-huh. I didn't like school. I still don't like school. I never liked the curriculum. I'm just not interested. If she wanted to do something different, why couldn't her parents just consider, considering that they are doing incredible, you know, look, being the queen of Hallmark and being the king of 90s Target fashion is not anything to sneeze at.
Yeah.
Why can't you just let her do the same thing?
I think that as people involved in higher education, I know that a lot of us have been starting to do this and talking about this. It's just sort of like, we have to reassess what our role is in the world and like what we're doing, especially with our universities, instead of reinforcing the kind of label branding stuff that that merely perpetuates our kind of relationship to, you know, getting your elite degree somewhere and having that be an art, or going to specific schools so that you have networks that you can tap into. We have to think more about like, what is the project of the university? What is it that we really want to do? I mean, you know, we could be a country like Germany, or where like it's free to go to school, and the people who want to go to college or get an advanced degree, they can do that.
I am working with a 23-year-old staff writer, and I give you one guess where she went to college. Like, it's just, there's not another way. You can be a 23-year-old and graduate from college and go to work writing for a TV show unless your parent is someone famous. And, like, that's still the lay of the land.
Well, this is the last thing I'll say about it. I know, like, because I was on Twitter all day. If you want to know more about what I think about it, you can look at that. But that one of the things that I liked about coming to USC is I finished my graduate education in a post-affirmative action, like, world. And that's when, you know, a school like Berkeley could not, like, consider diversity in its admissions, you know, processes in anything. And it was so refreshing to go to a private university where that was possible. That said, that also enables then, you know, these other ways, these other forms of side door, back door, like legacy stuff. And I don't know, we've just got to solve this shit by making education free for everyone.
Thank you.
All right, Margaret, what are you all about this week?
It's hard act to follow. I am all about, I've been listening like almost every waking hour I have for the last few days to this crazy podcast from the CBC. It's an investigative podcast called
Tell
Uncover.
Me More.
Yeah, right? There's so many pleasant Canadian accents, Guy. It actually softens the blow because it's all about escaping Nexium, which is the secretive sex cult, allegedly, based around Albany, New York, that was started by multi-level marketing guru Keith Raniere. You guys probably know the story a bit from last summer or last spring, where Raniere and his slave, Allison Mack from Smallville, were both charged with sex trafficking, racketeering, some other charges. And basically, NXIVM started as a sort of like self-empowerment kind of Scientology-esque group that just grew and grew and grew and eventually became really corrupt in that it started like a certain side group that was called DOS. I'll get to back to DOS in just a second, but the podcast revolves around Sarah Edmondson, who is a Canadian. She spent more than a decade in NXIVM. She ran all kinds of workshops. She opened a really successful chapter in Vancouver, and she's old friends with the reporter Josh Block, who is anchoring the whole podcast. And she was a true believer until she got recruited into DOS, the subgroup, and it was billed to her as just for women. But it was actually a sex cult servicing Ranieri. And the details that you get about her experience are just insane. I mean, first of all, it's amazing to me that she gets invited to something where she's supposed to call her old friend, Lauren, who invites her, Master. But hey, it's no big deal. It's just like some terminology. You just call me Master. It's not a big thing. You're my slave. Then you need to recruit your own slaves and so on and so forth so that it just becomes this like massive pyramid of masters and slaves and masters. And you're supposed to be on call anytime, day or night. Anytime your master even just texts you a question mark, you're supposed to just pop out of bed and respond in 1 minute. And if you don't, you get punished. You may have to fast the next day. You may have to do physical labor. In this crazy initiation ceremony, Edmondson is taken to this house around Albany, which she is pretty sure is Allison Mack's, and she gets branded with this symbol that turns out to be like Keith's initials and Allison Mack's initials. Like, it is just batshit insane. And the case against NXIVM, including Ranieri and Allison Mack and Claire Bronfman, who is the Seagram's heir, also really super involved in this cult. It's going to be picked back up in the news because his trial is about to start on April 29th. And actually just today he was charged with more things, including child pornography. So it's really a crazy story and a really riveting podcast.
Winter, what are you all about?
I watched Free Solo, which is about Alex Honnold. He attempts to conquer the first free solo climb of El Capitan in Yosemite. And it's not a movie that I would normally watch.
It won the Oscar for
best documentary. Yeah. The reason I love this documentary so much is I'm really always moved by people who are committed, fully committed to pursuing something that they want to conquer in spite of and having the discipline in spite of everything that's in front of him. They show that how he lives like a minimalist lifestyle, and it's not presented as like, look at the sacrifice. He's very comfortable about his lifestyle and like what he's into and what his focus is. And it's really to just scale El Capitan. Free solo, meaning he does it without ropes. Wow. So he goes up about like 15 to 2000 feet without a rope.
That's like a thing now, and it's so insane.
It's insane.
I mean, it's kind of a suicide mission.
It's a suicide mission. And I mean, the entire time I'm watching it, I was enthralled because I thought to myself, man, imagine being so committed to something that you are treating it as it's a part of your life. It's his lifestyle, but he's not obsessive about it. But he's even when you watch them in the documentary showing him when they're looking for places to live in Nevada while he's training and blah, blah, blah. He is thinking about this mountain, scaling this glass is what they call it, scaling that. It's a really, really, really interesting documentary. I never thought I would be interested in anything like this at all. But this guy's discipline, I love documentaries that talks about people's discipline and commitment to achieving something that is daunting and most people would not do.
Yeah,
I definitely think you should check it out. It was on Nat Geo. It's now on Hulu as of today. And I just can't say enough about it.
I will be free soloing El Capitan tomorrow. Now, you guys probably think that because Karen already went and talked about the thing that's going on with Felicity Huffman and Lori Loughlin, that you're not going to have to hear about an Australian reality show. You would be mistaken, because this week I was turned on to Zumbo's Just Desserts. Now, you've got, on the one hand, you've got Top Chef that is a very professional environment that is taking people who are at the top of their field and asking them to compete against each other in like a very branded space. Now, on the other hand, you've got Great British Baking Show where nice people from Cornwall come and make little biscuits with each other and try to be friends. Zumbo's Just Desserts is like strongly declaring Australia's place in the Commonwealth with a slightly hoary, like somewhat overblown pastry competitive cooking show. So Zumbo is a famous pastry chef in Australia. His job on the show is to do virtually nothing because he's got a woman named Rachel who hosts the show for him. And then he has a Brazilian-Australian woman named Gigi who comes and like comments on everything and says, "The clock is ticking," in a wonderful accent that is a combination of two accents of sexy nations and I think should be lauded. And then you just have like regular Australians who in the first part of the show, they're given sort of like a general kind of vibe. You have to do stuff only with yellow fruit or like it's a very big sort of like space and they can fill it with whatever they want. And what they want to fill it with is always pavlovas. They're never not making passion fruit pavlovas. And then the real innovation is that after you have a winner and then you have two people at the bottom. And if you guys know about reality shows with two people at the bottom, that means that they have to lip sync for their life, but with pastry. So they are presented a like Zumbo creation. Like the first episode, it is like a multi-layered dinosaur egg of a pastry thing covered in a mirror glaze that is like ridiculous. They're never going to be able to achieve it. And it's almost got that sort of like nailed it fun of they're never going to get there. But the thing is, these people are right at that level where sometimes they get there. Mm-hmm. Like sometimes they're able to make this shit, but sometimes it also like falls apart in front of them. And it is truly taxing and delightful. And also just like existing in sort of like a Wonka-esque ridiculous space as your forum. Like they do a lot of exteriors of the fact that it's like an abandoned factory, and it's dumb and ridiculous and a good competitive cooking show. And so I encourage at least Karen Tongson to watch it.
But is it a sex cult?
All right, you're listening to Pop Rock. We're going to be right back to talk about Lady Vengeance after this.
Hi, it's me, Paula Poundstone.
And it's me, Adam Felber.
We have a podcast called Nobody Listens to Paula Poundstone. It's a comedy podcast where we bring on experts to teach us stuff we need to know.
And by the way, the guy who came to tell us what to do when you encounter a bear never showed up.
Anyway, it's fun. You are guaranteed laughs in every episode.
You can't really guarantee laughs. What if somebody doesn't laugh? We'll get sued.
Join us for our next episode where we have an expert in consumer law explain to us how to defend ourselves against one humorless, litigious shut-in with enough time on their hands to sue us over our unfulfilled claim of guaranteed laughs in every episode here at MaximumFun.org.
The Cat of the Week is Mabel from Green Bank, West Virginia.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are
Winter Mitchell-Rabah,
Margaret Wappler,
and Karen Tongson.
This is March, the month of women's history, so we thought it fitting to focus on our lens on stories of women seeking revenge or justice, depending on your view. A good place to start was the Amazon documentary, Lorena. What was your guys' experience of Lorena, the documentary about Lorena Bobbitt and her assault of her husband's genitals?
We talked about this a little bit when Winter brought it up as an All About a few weeks ago, but Lorena, as a series, is really successful because it gets to, I think, you know, how important that event was for women who were suffering abuse and feeling like they could... They finally had someone who did the thing that they had in their minds at all times when they were suffering that abuse, just to cut the damn thing off, you know? And it was, you know, and it moves from the joke – And it opens with a scene where she's being joshed with by Steve Harvey, of all people. And then it gets to the real serious facts of the matter. And you know, without it manages to get at these lurid details without sensationalizing it all over again. And I really appreciated that.
The thing I thought was most interesting was the timeline play. The fact that you start out in 1993 when it happens, and then you move backwards and forwards to explore their relationship in their lives, but also backwards and forwards to talk about the things that were going on in our culture. The Anita Hill hearings, like all of the
Tailhook scandal.
Yes, all of the stuff that was contributing to this conversation about the fact that, like, I mean, I think the creepiest part of this documentary are the newscasters who are, like, chuckling this assault, but also at the concept of marital rape. It's a little bit confusing to them. You're married, or just hear what, like, Virginia's marital rape law at the time was like. You have to be separated and, like, have to have done grievous injury that, like I think it was, like, irreparable harm.
Yeah. I mean, at that point in 1993, half of the states didn't have anything about marital rape on the books. It didn't exist. That wasn't a real concept to half the country, if not more. And I think that the whole thing was thought of as a joke because it was, you know, this idea of women's wrath. You know what I mean? Just that she was, because what got played up early on, in which, you know, she testified to this herself in, like, the interview with the cops right after she did it, where she said something about, you know, he wouldn't let me orgasm, he always just orgasmed himself. And I mean, I think she was saying that out of just, like, total chaos in her brain. But you know, that was not the issue.
No,
I mean, that might have been one of many, 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 many issues.
He was coming and she wasn't.
Well, yeah. But I mean, she basically,
that's a problem.
She basically opened that topic a little bit of just, like, it being about sexual dissatisfaction, and so whoop, therefore she cuts his dick off. But, like, that wasn't really it. It was actually all this pent up rage and anger that she had over being assaulted again and again and again. And all of that just got buried in this, like, news storm of just the comedy of it and the outrageousness of it. And, like, what struck me about the documentary is how quickly men and women interpret it in different ways. Like, instantly the nurse who works on Bobbitt says, well, what did he do to her to make his wife do that? And the doctor says, wow, like, poor guy, got his dick cut off. You know what I mean? It's such a stark difference, and it made me think this is why it's important for women to be in positions of power too.
1993, as it reminds you, 93 to 94 is this shit show maelstrom of OJ and Tanya Harding and the
Anita
Bobbitts.
Hill.
Like, Anita Hill was 1989.
92.
What?
91.
It was earlier. 92. Yeah. But, 92. Like, do you think that it really was just, like, a weird little moment in time? Or do you think it was the moment we got the cable infrastructure to be able to have shit like this, that shit like this had been going on before, but the minute we had the cable infrastructure, you could create these circuses in a way that weren't possible before.
I think you can strike a correlation between how much more these events and these forms of violence and the violence against women was more visible through that cable infrastructure, and now what certain true crime podcasts are doing to expose how often men get away with murder.
Yeah.
With killing women, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I think that one of the shocking things when you kind of review, like, what's out there is, like, every other day, there's, like, a historical story, a current story, you know, whatever, a range of true crime stories where it's just like, yep, this dude just killed a bunch of women. And also, like, the thing about the Bobbitt story, and that's super striking from the jump of that documentary, is there's a woman who's shrieking and in pain, and the cops, you know, like, she's called the cops because
multiple
she was
times
assaulted, though. I mean, the day of the event, and all they're concerned about is finding the penis.
Yeah.
Like, they're just like, drop everything, we have to find the penis.
That's the best part of the way this documentary is set up, is that's, like, literally 30 minutes of the first episode.
Where'd it go?
The thing that I found interesting about her is that in the course of trying to establish what she went through versus his way of presenting the facts, he can't be taken seriously.
No.
Yeah. And that's the thing, is that he was taken so seriously in the beginning because he was injured.
Right.
He got all the attention. He was the victim. He got to go on Howard Stern. He got to go do all these TV shows and talk shows and go hang out on a ranch. Meanwhile, she's trying to figure out how to pay for this attorney, getting another attorney, trying to go to court, going to a halfway house. And it's better in the light of day now than it was presented and covered by media back then.
In 1991, Thelma and Louise came out. It's a movie about an attempted rape against one of the characters, the murder of the attempted rapist, and then the two women sort of like going on a road trip, fleeing after this like act of vengeance and violence. You know, not trusting that the legal system would be able to like understand that it was an act of self-defense. How do you think something like that coming out in 91 relates to, like, you know, do you think it helped women to see sexual violence as not a thing that was personal to them or their relationship, but a more structural problem?
I was going to talk about the difference between vengeance and justice when you have a system that doesn't take care of you, which I think is what happens with Lorena Bobbitt and other women that have had to take matters into their own hands. I mean, if you are a person getting abused and you call the cops and the cops just kind of come and go, all right, guys, walk it off. And that's all that happens 90% of the time, like, what are you supposed to do when the abuse just keeps raging on and on and on? And I think that's something that came into play with her case, is that men saw that as vengeance and women saw that as justice because there was no other recourse.
The thing is like the way that we looked at and talked about relationships of violence between men and women changed between the late 80s and the early 90s. During this period of time, you have sort of like Fatal Attraction coming out in 87, where it's a noble man just trying to go about his day and a crazy lady.
What are you so afraid of?
Hey, just don't flatter yourself, Alex.
Go ahead, hit me. If you can't fuck me, why don't you just hit me?
You're so sad. You know that, Alex? Lonely and very sad.
Don't you ever pity me,
I'll pity
smug
you.
Bastard.
I'll pity you because you're sick.
Why? Because I won't allow you to treat me like some slut you can just bang a couple of times and throw in the garbage.
He had sex with this woman and then sort of like left her behind and wouldn't deal with her because he was married, and she goes crazy and tries to kill him. And so he nobly gets to murder her in a bathroom. Or that was the original cut. Then that tested poorly. And so they made his poor goddamn wife have to come and do the murdering herself.
Right. I don't think people realize either, like, what a cultural touchstone that film was.
Yes.
Like when it was out. Like, I just remember all those jokes about, like, be careful, she might boil your bunny. You know, yeah. Like, that was just such a moment in time. And I think it was, you know, the ultimate safe space for women to sort of watch that movie and go, yep, I've wanted to do that kind of thing in my, like, blackest, darkest nightmares. I didn't, but, like, I'm glad somebody did. And it's, like, all played for horror and kind of laughs, kind of campy, but it's, like, it's also real.
Yeah, I mean, on the opposite end of the spectrum in the 80s, though, it, like, is a movie like The Burning Bed, which
yeah.
I know was the first time that I was made aware of, like, the topic of, you know, kind of vengeance explicitly, you know, for domestic abuse.
Wait until Mickey fell asleep. Is that right? Right?
Yes.
Then you took the kids out to the car, right? Then you got the gasoline out of the garage and you came back into the house, right? And you poured the gasoline around the bed and then you lit a match and ran to the car, right? Right?
Yes.
Okay, the kids were in the car and they were scared and crying and you started driving away. Francine, what were you doing? Where were you going?
Ran for my life. Ran for the life of my kids.
Like being rendered on, like it was on a TV,
TV
like special, right?
A right? TV movie. Or a TV movie with Farrah Fawcett.
With Farrah Fawcett. And I think it was 84. And you know, just because I think I grew up like in a very macho kind of environment when I was growing up outside of the country, but also like when I got here, that, you know, it wasn't uncommon for me to see abuse happening around me in those ways. And I just know that it came to my consciousness because I was like, see, it happens with other people and other people lash out. And I also know that, like, once I saw somebody, you know, basically have that enough is enough moment and, you know, throw boiling water on somebody who was attacking her. Mm. And that was a moment as a small child, I knew, okay, there's the limit. And that person never touched her again. Mm-hmm. Right. And so, like, so those stories kind of coming together and then going to the Lorena story from that, like, I mean, I think that, you know, it's, I don't know. I think that those are, that's sort of where, like, the vengeance justice thing, like, is, like, where I connect onto it as a form of storytelling is because of that, like, again, that just, like, huge kind of cultural environment that sanctions that behavior towards women.
Let us briefly discuss a different kind of revenge movie.
Oh, please.
A revenge movie, not with weapons, but with words. And I speak, of course, of Irreconcilable Differences. A truly great movie where you have a happy couple, man who leaves his wife, and then woman who writes tell-all book that takes him down. And for me, that is an infinitely more fun and playful, like, comparing that to something like The War of the Roses,
right.
The, like, late 90s black comedy about a couple getting a divorce who end up killing each other. Mm-hmm. It's just so much more fun when the people tearing each other apart are doing it with words, ideas, and money.
Yes, because I think, well, I don't know why this movie didn't do better. I've talked about it before, but this movie is essentially a Hollywood story that's based on Polly Platt and Peter
Bogdanovich
and their messy divorce because he had an affair on the Last Picture Show with Sybil Shepherd.
Right? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's a movie that sort of dramatizes and editorializes what happened and occurred. I love that movie so much because it's words. They're not cutting penises off. They're not driving over anything and killing you or killing the cat or pretending that it's pate. They're just basically taking what they know best and trying to go after each other. And I've talked about this before, how the scene where Shelley Long is in the grocery store and she just dropped the daughter off for the New Year's Eve party. The daughter is played by Drew Barrymore. And she looks and she sees the reflection of herself in the mirror and she's just mortified at what she's become. And then goes on to write this bestseller. That's a great moment. But can we, yes. I don't know why we haven't brought up She-Devil, because it's Roseanne's in it.
Yes.
But She-Devil's a good movie. We can move on.
Tell everybody what She-Devil's about.
I mean, fuck you, Roseanne, but She-Devil is an amazing movie. However, She-Devil is Roseanne, Meryl Streep, Ed Begley Jr., who was like the hot nerdy guy of the 80s. If you don't know who he is, you can Google him. He's insane elsewhere. And Roseanne is this put upon, portly housewife who's married to an accountant who gets Meryl Streep, who is a very successful best-selling romance author, as his client, and then starts sleeping with her. And then he throws Roseanne and their kids to the side, and she immediately, I mean, she blows up the house within 15, 20 minutes, dumps the kids on him, goes out and finds fortune for herself, and then decides to ruin his entire life. It's such a fucking good movie. It's 95 minutes.
I mean, but also, like, the shift to no-fault divorce in the United States and sort of, like, shifting cultural norms about divorce kind of informed this, like, change in understanding of what was possible for women. Like, it used to be that marriage was a sentence that you just had to live out,
right.
And it became a situation where people could leave. I would like to talk about another tone of sort of, like, female revenge movie, and that is just one that uses the concept of, like, injury to open up the possibility of a woman being on a murderous rampage. Does anyone remember the 1996 Sally Field movie, An Eye for an Eye?
Yes, yeah, never saw it.
Kiefer Sutherland home invasion, rapes her, like, 16-year-old daughter, and then Sally Field just goes to try to find him so she can shoot him. And my mom wanted to see that movie so much. My mom wanted to see a movie where a woman was freed to be, like, a vigilante murderer so much.
Like Double Jeopardy.
And it really took something that grievous as an inciting incident to someone so close to her and her family to be able to set that movie up to be a thing in 1996, because we didn't really understand women holding guns then.
You know, like two vengeance stories that I really absolutely adore, one darker and the other one lighter, of course. First is Charlize Theron as Eileen Wuornos in Monster.
Love.
You know, I mean, I think that that is, like, it's just an amazing portrayal. Also, that just, you know, like, the kind of intermingling of sexuality and you know, again, sexuality, sexual violence, etc. But the other one is a much more delightful tale of revenge and success, and that's 9 to 5, which is, like, a totally formative film for me. And I love when, like, you can achieve revenge in these movies through, like, humor.
Judy, you've got to help me. That mob has gone crazy out there. They're trying to kill me.
Well, why would they want to do a nasty thing like that?
I don't know. I'm not such a bad guy.
You're a sexist, egotistical, lying, hypocritical bigot.
So I have a few faults. Who doesn't? Is that any reason to kill me?
And I think that's one of the first movies where I realized that, you know, being clever and, you know, outwitting the person who has all the power but none of the brains is the way that, you know, the way that we're going to be able to get through this world, really. And, you know.
Yeah, on the lighter tip, one of my favorites is First Wives Club, which I actually got a big, like, hankering to rewatch when I saw Bette Midler singing on the Oscars. Like, there's just something about seeing her perform again that I was like, oh, Bette, like, I need to dive back into some of her work. And First Wives Club is just, the first hour of it is really joyous and pretty perfect. And it's Goldie Hawn, Diane Keaton, and Bette Midler, and they all basically have been left by their husbands in one way or another. And there's actually a scene of them talking about how they are going to get revenge by starting the First Wives Club.
Bill, you know, I gave him a career and he's still mine. I worked behind the cash register in his first store, in his first 15 stores.
Yeah, well, I gave Aaron a home and I gave him a daughter. I washed his shorts, I ironed them, I starched them.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, well, I mean, I supervised.
Oh, so what? All right, what? What are we saying? What do we want? Revenge?
No, we are not talking about revenge. No, I am talking about justice. I'm going to give that Aaron so much justice he can't even see straight if he thinks his partner's are trouble.
Yeah, well, Bill's always had it easy.
That's right.
Why? Why?
Goes on and on from there in just a beautiful way. Goldie Hawn alone with her lips in this movie, amazing acting.
Why is Diane Keaton's delivery of that line so iconic?
It's so funny.
I remember it so much. It feels like she forgot what she was saying halfway through, but also it's Diane Keaton. That's what she does.
Yes, where she always sounds a little bit like she's forgetting the thread of what she's saying.
It's so good. It's so satisfying. And also having that vengeance that feels satisfying to the soul. What you want to see is the bad guy brought low. Like, not killed or destroyed.
Right.
Like,
just humiliated.
Yes. You don't want to see his penis cut off. You just want to see his penis useless to him because society no longer values
emasculation in the financial realm and other realms, not necessarily.
You know,
penis.
Sometimes it's like castration in all forms. I think I'm okay with that.
But we didn't even talk about Kill Bill.
Which is entirely.
Yes, although I feel
entire
kind of,
plot.
I feel differently about it now because Uma Thurman, like, what was it, last year doing all the Me Too stuff, like, came out and said Tarantino didn't treat her well on the set.
And see, I think it's one of the best performances she's ever done. I mean, it's iconic. Mm-hmm. And it goes back to The Shining, and you hear about
Kubrick?
Stanley Kubrick.
Sorry. You go back and you think about, on The Shining, Stanley Kubrick's treatment of Shelley Duvall and how it brought forth one of the best
performances. I mean, she was given us great performances before and after, and that's one of the things that kind of drove her out of acting.
Well, no, I understand, but, like, I only followed her up into she did, like, her little fairy tale stories that she would do on PBS and HBO. I mostly knew her at that point in my life from The Shining. So that is an iconic moment for me. And then when I think about Kill Bill and I think about how I never paid attention to an Uma Thurman movie before nor after. Okay, Truth About Cats and Dogs. But you know, in that role where she systematically goes after all of these women and men for 2 movies, almost 4 hours. And that brings me to another point, because I know he's a piece of shit, but Death Proof. Death Proof, I don't care what anybody says about the whole series as a whole, where he kind of does these two movies and goes back and forth and tries to sort of recapture that era of like horror, schlocky exploitation films. Death Proof is one of the best revenge movies for women ever. Just 2.5 hours of slow plotting, watching these women try to go and enjoy themselves on a ride about doing something super incredibly masculine that you would think is more masculine than anything, racing, going and buying a race car, racing it around this desolate highway, and then going back and killing this guy that tortured them. I love that film. To me, that is my favorite revenge movie.
Can I tell you guys my favorite line? My favorite female revenge plot, like, dialogue line is from a little play by the name of Much Ado About Nothing. There's a moment in it when, like, Beatrice is like, she needs to be able to prove that her cousin is not a whore who's been fucking around, and these guys have been talking shit about her cousin. And there's a moment where she says, "Oh, if I were a man, I would eat his heart in the marketplace." And the number of times that I have felt that way, I just, it's like it's also such insight to be like, to be in a game of like violence and dehumanization that you like can't fight back the same way in. It's just so juicy. I love that line so much.
Go ahead. I was going to ask a question, actually, a little bit separate from the eating the heart of the marketplace, but we've so far been talking about a lot of great films, but it's mostly like stories about white women who can exact their revenge on men. And the thing about Lorena that was striking as a documentary is that her race and racialization, her immigration status, her brownness was so much used against her,
especially from her own husband.
Yeah,
I mean,
and I'm wondering, like, what are some of these other stories, or like, is that just a story that can't be told unless it's like kind of within the kind of the kind of interracial dramas?
Well, I think in the 90s, any of those movies suffered from the same curse as all of Hollywood did, which was this assumption that no one would want to watch a story about this if it didn't involve beautiful white women. You know, we can only handle the revenge fantasy if it's like carried out by, you know, like,
well, but I think The Color Purple, whatever. The Color Purple probably is a vengeance. You know, at the end, she kind of gets
it does
what
have,
she wants.
Yeah, it does have those kind of
and becomes
elements,
who she wants to be.
But I feel like that's like got Steven Spielberg's weight behind it at the top of his game. Well, I mean, can I just add real quick that First Wives Club is being rebooted, actually, for BET, and it's going to be on with like Jill Scott and some other people.
Miss Michelle Buteau.
Yes.
I'm very excited.
Like, I think that's pretty cool.
Like, more recently, you've got a film like Obsession, or as I prefer to call it, Beyonce hits a white lady with a phone. But it was, you know,
you took my child.
Like, it was a revenge story, but one where sort of like race and gender were being played in very like hack ways of like, this white lady stole my man, I am going to, or like, this white lady had sex with my man and now she's after him and I have to like defend this family. And it's like not great to have this story being played out about, you know, women beating each other. Like, it's just Fatal Attraction all over again, with Ann Archer getting to do more and being a good singer. Karen, I would like to suggest that possibly one of the best, like, vengeance stories about a woman of color that we've made is What's Love Got to Do with It?
Oh,
that
really sort of
success,
like,
success is the best revenge.
Yes, success and not giving a shit. Yes, it is the fact that she is a huge success by the mid-80s, but it's also that fucking Buddhism, that she gets to a point that he don't mean anything to her anymore.
Like Freddy. They totally went the Freddy route. You don't matter. They do it in Freddy Krueger movies. Okay, she like turns her, the final girl turns her back on him and then he disappears. The whole notion where every time in What's Love Got to Do with It that she had, she thought was the ultimate plan, and he came through with his henchmen, and he came through with his money, and he came through with the promises, and she still found her, I mean, that's the only reason she can exist as she's a Pop Rocket seal of approval, first winner.
The only, only one who's not tarnished.
That's not tarnished.
In our girl.
I mean, she's our final girl. I just think that that movie, watching that movie, and I don't think people knew. I like when people on Twitter talk about the fact that they react to it now differently than they did then because of what we've learned in the last 20 or 30 years about how widespread and vast abuse against women, even in a marriage.
There's always been this conservatism to male vigilante sort of movies, like Falling Down or like the Dirty Harry movies, when it's just sort of like, I'm not going to pay attention to the law. I'm going to shoot whoever gets in my way. And so frequently those end up being black and brown people. What do you think is sort of like the distinction in tone between revenge movies that are about women and about men?
I think it's that, you know, the kind of grievance, the masculine grievance is always seen as a kind of global everyman thing, whereas female stories are often seen as individualized and circumstantial and it's part of their situation, even though we as women know that it's not. And I think that that's one of the things, is that people can universalize the frustration of falling down.
I speak slowly and distinctly.
Take the money!
You think I'm a thief? No. You see, I'm not the thief. I'm not the one charging 85 cents for a stinking soda! You're the thief! Just standing up for my rights as a consumer.
Well, I think, too, that there's this classic difference between men's pictures and women's pictures, right? And that women's pictures are domestic and it's all about like what happens in their own little sphere. And so therefore, I think a lot of people have thought they can just cast it off because it's like, well, you were just married to an asshole. That's what happened to you. But it's not like the whole world is beating down on your shoulders like Michael Douglas. Well, you know what I mean? Like, it's not like everything is getting to you. The environment, the money-making capitalist machine, like being in the rat race, blah, blah, blah. Like these bigger concerns were always supposedly the purview of men, and therefore their struggles are more valuable.
It's why it's so great that Thelma and Louise is outside so much.
Yes.
That they're in a convertible in like a whiter world.
It's a road trip movie, which was the province of men too.
And also like almost overwhelmed by the space around them. Like, what do we even do in this space? And the fact that that movie, by having an ending, look, it happened 30 goddamn years ago, but having an ending where they don't have to resolve and find a life. That somehow driving into the Grand Canyon is a better resolution than any of the sort of practical resolutions we could imagine for them.
It's a really radical ending.
Yeah.
You know, it's like I still think about that ending and think, wow, I almost can't believe that happened. Like,
yeah.
In like a very popular 90s movie.
Well, I do deeply love that, like, the one good cop who's trying to understand isn't enough.
Nope.
You know, like, it's not, let's not rest all of our hopes on that guy.
Right.
That's not going to fix it.
That ruins a certain sort of good guy fantasy that I think a lot of men do carry around.
Yeah.
Like, if they're the good guy, like, that's enough. Right. Right. And it's like, well, it's a whole system.
It's just 2 days before retirement.
You are listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back after this.
Good morning, class.
Good morning, Ms. Banks.
Can anyone tell me which holiday is coming up? This major holiday celebrates giving and artistic expression.
Max Fun Drive!
That's right, kids. It's Max Fun Drive. And when do we celebrate?
March 18th through March 29th.
Very good, Billy. Now, who can tell us the story of Max Fun Drive?
I know. Me.
All right, Trisha.
Once a year, the Pod Fairy comes to town and hands out cool enamel pins of your favorite podcast. Oh, they're so effing cool.
Whoa, yes, Trish. But there's more to the Max Fun Drive holiday than cool pins. Max Fun Drive is the time of year when all around the world, people put aside their differences and focus on the spirit of family, friends, community, and podcasts. Bye. Oh, okay, class. Don't forget to listen to your favorite podcast from March 18th to 29th. I'll expect full pod reports when you're back. I have got to ask someone why these classes are only 45 seconds long.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are
Winter Mitchell-Roba,
Margaret Wappler,
and Karen Tongson.
Every week on Pop Rocket, we ask our panel, what's your current jam? So I ask, Ms. Rorba, what's your current jam?
I just discovered this young woman today in my Spotify. Her name is Charlotte Day Wilson. She is a queer woman from Canada. Guy, you will be intrigued. She has a song that she has named Work, and she has done multiple songs with a lot of this, like, OVO. OVO is like Drake's little collective of people who make emo R&B. It's like music to screw by. I thought because it's Women's History Month, we would stick to what I care about the most, and that's the vagina. and she, you know, I chose this song. It's a really great it's a really great tune.
How many quadrants?
Oh, every single one.
Ding, 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 ding,
ding, ding, ding. And Monica Geller would say 7.
Margaret Wappler, what is your jam?
My jam is definitely on the revenge tip. This is from the Pistol Annies. This is a country supergroup, if you don't know, with Miranda Lambert, Angelina Presley, and Ashley Monroe. This song is from their 2018 album, Interstate Gospel, and it is just coming out with all guns blazing. Got my name changed back. It takes a judge to get married, takes a judge to get divorced. Well, the last couple of years, spent a lot of time in court, got my name changed back. Yeah, yeah. I got my name changed back. Yeah, yeah. Well, I wanted something new, then I wanted what I had. I got my name changed back. Yeah, yeah.
Social Problem Woo! Women's Country is like just the best world.
Country dishes out the best lady revenge, doesn't
I
it?
I agree. I really just felt like genre. I needed to go straight to that genre to tap it. There's no hope in pop and rock. Not really. Not for revenge.
No, it's so good. Karen, what about you?
This isn't so vengeful, but there's some interesting lines in it. It's from the LA-based Welsh chanteuse and guitarist Kate Le Bon, and this is called I Just Want to Be Good from her EP Rockpool. I don't want to be the cold cards lying on your floor. I don't want to be the stray dog scratching at your door. I don't want sympathy for feeling underwears or thinking I won't do. I populate the great pipe with unholy thoughts, and I wear them like they're true. I just want to be good. I don't know. I think it's a languid form of female empowerment. So.
No, I love her. I love her. It's funny. It
sounds like
you
Jenny
and,
Lewis.
As you and Winter played your jams, I was like, these are Margaret jams.
Yeah.
And then I just played a guy jam, basically.
It really is. I'm going to be playing a Karen jam. Carly Rae is back.
Wow.
What?
She went for it.
Yeah.
She might get me back. Or get me there in the first place.
All right, let me. This is why we should let pop stars happen at 29.
Woo!
But because, like, she didn't have someone hurt her or start dating Pete Davidson and decided that she needed to go into a whole new phase of her career and never be fun again. Like, Carly Rae knows what she loves to do, and she keeps delivering it. And, like, she grows and gives us new things without, like, feeling the need to abandon her former self.
Love it. She's a jam monster.
I love her. You have been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Branum, with Margaret Wampler, Winter Mitchell Robot, and Karen Thompson. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. We would like to thank everyone for the 5-star reviews on iTunes. If you haven't already, please review us. This week we have a couple, and Margaret is feeling fine. Like, she's ready for the summertime.
So healthy. So strong.
Yes. This week we would like to thank Gladys Kravitz. They say, please stop it with the fake reviews. Terry Crews, it's unfortunate that the second Pop Rocket seal of approval was for this POS. Please review this and not let it slide. Guy, your gay fans are paying attention. Stop this. The person did give the show 5 stars. Look, we made a seal of approval. Everyone is problematic. I am problematic. I make bad choices on a regular basis. If you guys would like to cancel me, that's cool. If you would like to respect the work that I do and understand that I, like all people, need to grow, then that seems a whole lot more reasonable to me. We would also like to thank...
Woo! I love that response.
Ella Karen's mom. Like Margaret, I'm a mother of a 1-year-old human, and as a result, feel as though I've lost touch with popular culture. Enter Pop Rocket. These passionate, brilliant, cutting, when appropriate, and hilarious rocketeers have brought me back from cultural Siberia. Shout out to Sam Sanders for introducing me to this amazing guy.
Thanks, Sam Sanders.
Thanks, Sam
Yay.
Sanders.
Next Glad week, we can have a play date with you.
We are going back to college, and I'm going to be honest. We did bribe a lacrosse coach to get the opportunity. Specifically, we are going to the University of Southern California for a live taping in front of Professor Thompson's class.
Be fun, everybody. Get your thumb fingers out.
Woo-hoo!
Professor, 2 questions. First, what are that day's lessons plans?
It's going to be both personal and grand because we're going to talk about why pop culture matters. It's a big idea. Why it matters to each of us, what brought us into our lives of pop pontificating, what scenes made or broke us, and to fit in with the curriculum because we've been covering things historically, what pop culture things of the last 10 years do we feel will stand the test of time?
What a great question. Second, is this live taping at USC's Camilleri Hall only available to matriculated students, or is it open to the public?
It's actually open to the public. I think the last time I checked, we only had about 10 tickets left, folks.
Woo! Wow.
So that's out of 100. Please, you know, if you want tickets, it's free. Doesn't cost you $500,000.
Just but I will take it.
RCP to Eventbrite. If you want to bring us bribes, you're more than welcome to.
Cake.
And yeah, come on up. We'll see you there.
And guys, if you want us to hear your feedback or even ask a panelist for advice, you can call 530-237-4108. We want to know what you have to say. Get in touch with us on Twitter. We're at Pop Rocket, or join our Facebook group and get in the discussion. We are a production of MaximumFun.org, and our senior producer is Laura Swisher. Laura Johanna Swisher.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.